The words we live by. The National Broadcasting Company and its affiliated independent stations present The Words We Live By, the summer series of the Eternal Light program, which comes to you under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. Today, we present the ninth in this series of 15 literary dialogues on democracy and the Bible, featuring two of America's foremost men of letters, Maurice Samuel and Mark Van Doren.
Last week, Mark, at the end of our talk, you threw me into a little bit of a panic by introducing a new line of thought which has been very active in my mind on the relationship between what we call progress vis-à-vis democracy and progress vis-à-vis the biblical world of thought. And it occurs to me that we have two concepts, really, of progress. There is one in which the accumulation of knowledge or of power is, in a sense, automatic and has to do simply with experience in relation to the mechanics of the world. That is to say, scientific experience gives us this information, that information, and the more we have of that, the more we're able to control our surroundings. And in this sense, there is what you might call absolute progress independently of the progress of the human being as a human being. I can imagine an inhuman scientific accumulation which would lead to the most tremendous exercise of power over physical circumstance. That would be progress in one sense. Progress in the other sense, namely, the evolution of the human being is a much slower and much deeper thing, and that is envisaged chiefly in the Bible, the growth of man in himself. Whether democracy envisages that more strongly than the Bible or otherwise is a matter to be deeply considered.
Yes, and I even raised the question, you may remember, whether that kind of progress takes place at all. Whether there's any sign that there is a general forward movement in virtue, shall we say, or in goodness, I just don't know whether there is or not. I remember, now that you speak of science, I remember that almost 300 years ago in England, and I dare say in all of Europe, there was a great debate about whether the ancients or the moderns were the wiser. It was called the Battle of the Books. Jonathan Swift wrote a book with that title. Whether it would be wise to rest upon ancient knowledge or to reject it and vote for modern knowledge. Well, the distinction was made even then between scientific knowledge, which, as you say, advances steadily and moves forward on a certain front generation by generation, so that the last generation of scientists is probably the best, only because it is the last and can assume more knowledge because more has been had. There's a distinction made between that kind of advance and the kind of advance that might be supposed to be made in the arts. And it was pointed out that there'd been no steady advance in the arts, that poetry, the drama, storytelling, painting for that matter, and music are good at certain times for reasons that nobody knows, and then bad at certain times for a reason that nobody knows. Homer, if he's the first of poets, is still the first of poets, in terms of quality. Never been improved on. No matter how many poets you've had since, they don't seem to get any better. The fact that one poet is later than Shakespeare doesn't argue that he's going to be better than Shakespeare.
No. We might put it in this form. Newton was a very great scientist. Some think of him as the greatest scientist that ever lived.
He certainly was wonderful.
Nevertheless, today a college boy knows everything that Newton knew and can acquire with a modicum of application and of intelligence all of the processes that went into Newton's elaborate and, at that time, very difficult reconstruction of the forces of the universe in order to account for the motion of the planets. We can therefore say that this schoolboy, this is a common phrase, stands on the shoulders of Newton. No doubt if Newton were living today, he would be, another Newton, meaning an Einstein of today.
Yes.
But we can't talk of any writer or any moralist today standing on the shoulders of Isaiah.
No, that's right.
It's impossible to conceive of someone saying, oh, Isaiah, well, he lived 2,800 years ago. We know so much more now about the moral condition of man and what human beings ought to be like. So that this question of education and of progress, and we link the two, puts us up against a difficult problem of what does progress consist of in the inner human value, the ultimate humanness of the human being? Does it consist in our accumulation of new knowledge or of the accumulation of experience in contemplating the old? The Bible is so heavily weighted in the direction of study. Tells us that a man cannot be wise, cannot be good unless he is wise, that the fool cannot be a pious man. That was taken over from the Bible into the Mishnah. That if you are not anxious to look into the causes of the moral processes in you, you will never acquire anything like an approach to God or approach to perfection in your relationship to human beings. Are we any more advanced in that problem dealing with human beings than they were in the biblical literature of 2,500 years ago?
I think I've been suggesting that I do not think we are. I doubt that there is such a thing as steady, inexorable advance on that front. Now, when we use the word progress these days, we often have a very limited standard by which to measure the thing. I dare say there's progress in medicine. We know that certain diseases are now at our mercy, which didn't used to be at our mercy, and we can add those to the ones that were. We know that in physics or chemistry or astronomy, knowledge does advance. And the latest astronomer or the latest physicist or the latest chemist, like your boy, can assume that he has moved or been moved forward. It isn't that he's moved himself. He's been moved. He's on a train. I think oftentimes when people use the word progress, they are taking a single standard by which to judge it. A standard which I often hear invoked is this. Do we have more power over nature than men used to have?
We have, yeah. There's no question about that. That we have devised techniques, and as a result of certain experiments, can now foretell what will be the highly probable consequences of a given course of action. We have more control over nature. Have we more control over human nature?
Yeah, that's the question. I personally doubt it very much. But you know, Bertrand Russell, whom we've mentioned here a number of times, and who, by the way, for me is an extremely interesting figure as of this moment in human history, because there the old man stands in Trafalgar Square in London with a hair, wind blowing through his white hair, saying what he believes, regardless of what anyone else believes.
And that is
being willing to go to jail for it.
Yes, and that his intention is good and that it's filled with nobility is not to be denied by anyone. I don't care what one says about the particular applicability at the moment. If there were dozens, scores of Bertrand Russells, we should be all the better for it.
I think that's what we should look for. We should be ashamed that there are not more persons like him among us, with the kind of courage which permits him to say what he believes, even though it is dangerous, even though he will be scorned, even though he will be laughed at. He once said, however, would you like me to read, or would you like to read?
You read it out. This is a passage that I'm tremendously fond of. Read it out, because I'm going to hog a lot of time afterwards.
All right.
To comment on it.
All right, I wish you would. He said something of the utmost interest to me in connection with this suggestion that maybe progress is measured these days by people only in terms of the question of whether nature is being further and further conquered. He said, the attitude of man toward the non-human environment has differed profoundly at different times. The Greeks, with their dread of hubris and their belief in a necessity or fate, carefully avoided what would have seemed to them insolence toward the universe. The Middle Ages carried submission still further. Initiative was cramped by this attitude, and great originality was scarcely possible. The Renaissance restored human pride, but carried it to the point where it led to anarchy and disaster. But modern techniques, while not altogether favorable to the lordly individual of the Renaissance, has revived the sense of the collective power of human communities. Man, formerly too humble, begins to think of himself almost as a god. In all this, I feel a grave danger, the danger of what might be called cosmic impiety. The concept of truth, as something dependent on facts largely outside human control, has been one of the ways in which philosophy hitherto has inculcated the necessary element of humility. When this check upon pride has been removed, a further step has been taken along the road to a certain kind of madness, to which modern men, whether philosophers or not, are prone. I am persuaded that this intoxication is the greatest danger of our time, and that any philosophy which, however unintentionally, contributes to it, is increasing the danger of vast social disaster.
Well, that's a
what
very...
What a statement.
Yes, it's a very great passage from a very great book, from Russell's History of Western Philosophy. And there's a great pathos in this passage, both by virtue of the intrinsic content and by virtue of the relationship to Bertrand Russell himself.
Yeah.
Bertrand Russell has on many occasions been accused of mysticism. There were times in his life when he was deeply inclined toward a mystical view of the universe, yet he is the most rigorously logical of modern thinkers, and his work with Whitehead, De Principia, the book on modern mathematics, is supposed to be the most intellectual and the most severe test of purely technical logic that there is. Mathematical logic in the 20th century. Yet here there is a cry in him which is akin to the cry of a prophet.
That's right.
When the prophets foretold that human beings, this is in Isaiah, would have to hide in the holes of the earth when the Lord comes and shakes the earth terribly with his might, he puts it in this calmer language, yet the calmness of which does not cover the catastrophic intimation, increasing the danger of vast social disaster. Now, he wrote this before there was the problem of the atom bomb and the hydrogen bomb and so on. But increasing the danger of vast social disaster is the prophetic cry. He doesn't permit himself to put it in prophetic language because he will not accept the literally the literature of the Bible. Yet here is the problem. He speaks of cosmic impiety.
Yes.
Well, impiety toward whom? Toward what? Can a dead cosmos be considered as something which can inspire piety? Can you feel piety to empty spaces and to blindly, dumbly, colorlessly, soundlessly revolving galaxies?
Well, Maurice, I don't think he meant a dead cosmos. He spoke, or unknown to us, and perhaps forever unknowable. Maybe something very instructive in a memory I have of him, and I think I've mentioned it to you before. Some 20 years ago, when I used to participate in a series of radio conversations called Invitation to Learning, one day he was on the panel with myself and another man. The other man was a philosopher, too. I say, Russell, the other man, was a philosopher. Well, we all went to my house afterwards that day. And we got to talking about various things, and my friend said, defined religion. Something moved him to define religion as the art of dealing with our ignorance. It is the art of dealing with our ignorance. And Russell said, what do you mean, our ignorance? He was brushing it aside. Well, my friend said, aren't you interested in your ignorance? Russell said, no, I'm not. I'm interested only in what I know or think I can know.
That is the attitude of the positivist.
Yes, but I think he's changed in this.
I don't know where he stands now.
No, I don't either.
With this remarkable man, there have been these back and forth movements between what I would essentially call a religious attitude and what I would call an irreligious attitude. He has a famous passage in another of his books in which he talks of this blind, dead universe, I was referring to that before, in which man stands alone and in which he must find, he doesn't give us where, The man will find it, or for what reasons he will find it, in which man must find the courage to assert himself against this utter blankness of the universe. Mm-hmm. Well, there is a painful, everlastingly tragic problem here. Obviously, or to me at any rate, the man was made for belief. His mind struggles with it.
Yeah.
And out of this duality, out of this tension which there is in him between the poet-prophet on the one hand and the purely logical construct man on the other, we get these illuminating passages.
And that is why, perhaps, the spectacle of him in Trafalgar Square is so moving, isn't it?
Yes.
He had to overcome a great deal in his past and in his own mind to do that utterly simple thing of standing there and defying anyone to arrest him because he was making his protest. As a matter of fact, he was arrested, as you know. Well, he's, in my mind, one of the most moving figures of our time and highly relevant to all that we're talking about this summer. There's your individual judgment operating.
There's another man, an interesting man. I wouldn't put him, and this is not intended offensively, I wouldn't put him in the class with Bertrand Russell. I'm thinking of C.P. Snow, who placed before us, again, in quite non-religious terms, the problem of modern man and the struggle between what he calls the humanities and the scientific education. Yeah. Mark, you must have come across his little book.
The Two Cultures.
The Two Cultures, yes.
Oh, yes, yes, I know it very well.
I couldn't think of the name for the moment.
I've heard him talk about it.
Yes. Well, he puts the problem before us. It's funny how shy people are today of the word God. They're afraid of being dragged into some sort of ecclesiastical or rabbinical dispute. I don't know what it is, but it's essentially the same thing. Here, C.P. Snow is chiding the two worlds, the humanistic world and the scientific world, for their alienation from each other. And he, on the whole, makes the assertion that you cannot be an intelligent man today without having something like an equal training in both the sciences and the humanities. I wonder, do you look upon a scientific training? Let us say that I'm using an arbitrary figure. Let's say that 50% of the education has to be in the sciences. Otherwise, you can't be a complete human being nowadays. Do you subscribe to that point of view?
Yes, I think I do. I regret, for instance, that I know as little science as I do. I feel myself handicapped, very seriously handicapped. The world we live in is a world made, among other things, by scientists. I don't mean altogether made by them, and I don't think they believe so either. But put it this way, am I in a position to judge them or to ask them to call a halt in their experiments, or to ask them to cease to be what they are? Am I in any position to do that unless I know, in a way, how to talk to them in their own language? I find the present world rather impotent because this division is so sharp between the moral and the mathematical.
No, let me
the moral and the mathematical. I would put it that way. Instead of saying humanistic and scientific, I would say moral and mathematical.
Well, Mark, let me put to you a very painful question that haunts me. Do you know how much work it would need on your part and how much of a training it would need on your part to enable you to talk to those scientists in their own language?
I can't do it now, but I do not forgive the university I went to. I won't name it, because it permitted me to remain ignorant of chemistry and physics.
Well,
I know that what I would have got of those sciences then was very, very little, but I might have got something that would have kept me going somehow or other.
Well, let me put a simple, a very relevant question to you. I've been trying to look recently into the fallout problem.
Yes.
And I have discovered, with some little training in science, that you've got to devote a whole lot of time and have an immense background when you have men of the stature of a Linus Pauling and of a Teller.
Yes.
On opposite sides of the fence with regard to this question. Do you think there would be anything less than a very thorough scientific training you could participate in that debate and tell one of them where he's wrong?
Well, now, I should like to think that we lived in a world in which a man who was not a scientist comparable to either of those, in which a man in authority, shall we say, might say, very well, gentlemen, if you disagree. One of you says that it's this dangerous, the other of you say it's that dangerous. One of you says the danger is very great, the other says it's relatively slight. I say that if there's any danger at all, let's not do this.
Well, then, very good. But that's not a scientific answer.
Therefore, you're going back to
a position which I would occupy, or not you're going back, you're asserting a position which I would share, namely, that it is the moral consensus which has to rule. Do you know that with scientists, and as it happens in the last two or three years, I've been making rather ludicrous efforts the last 4 or 5 years to take chemistry courses and physics courses.
Yeah, I know you have.
Yes.
You've gone to Israel to do this.
Yes, I've done that sort of thing. It's a bit silly, you know, barging in on people and putting these questions and taking lessons. But I feel very much like the man who calls in the plumber or the man to fix the TV. I cannot fix the TV, and I can't take time out to learn to fix the TV or to fix my watch or to fix my radio or to fix the plumbing or to fix the plaster. And here are people who are dealing with the plaster of the universe. The plaster is beginning to tumble. And I'm suddenly asked to become a plasterer. Well, we can't be plasterers. We can have some notion of we want the plaster to be thus and thus. But I can't go to the tailor either and say, look, make the suit this way, because if you don't, it'll be thus and thus. All I can tell him is, it suits me or it doesn't suit me.
Well, now Maurice, let me answer the question that you put to me pretty directly this way. I'm not saying that the moral decision would be made by light-minded persons who just sentimentally shrank in fear and disgust of something that they didn't understand. I should like to think that our society recognized the right and indeed the duty of certain serious persons to ask this very serious question in the light of this disagreement, in the light of the possibility that irreparable damage could be done to, not only to us, but to all the world that we know anything about. Maybe we should do nothing for a while. Maybe we should hesitate. Maybe we should not assume that we have to keep on investigating things which could destroy us if investigated further. You know, the arrogance involved in this is really quite dreadful to contemplate. Sometimes it seems to me that the Russian and the American people are very arrogant. They're only a fraction of the human race. They are talking as if either or both of them had a right to destroy human life on Earth, in spite of the fact that 4/5 of the people who would be destroyed are neither Russian nor American. And neither do they think of all the animals and plants that would die, too. Life might go. That is cosmic impiety. It's terrestrial impiety, but it's also cosmic impiety.
It is cosmic because we are a focus of the universe. We are a focus of the cosmos.
Now, I know what you mean when you ask me how difficult it would be. I remember Snow, somewhere in his little book, The Two Cultures, saying that, of course, for anyone now to move to the front of mathematical inquiry requires almost superhuman effort. He said, I know how difficult it is. And he does know.
But then...
He's not only a novelist, he not only is a writer of works of literary art, but he is a scientist.
Well, he is a capable man. I can't say that I've been completely won over by his literary work. I've read it. All right.
No, I have respect
work.
For it.
And I've been told, yes, it's all right. It's respectable. Which is perhaps damning with faint praise.
Well,
I don't put him side by side with most important writers. As for his science, I'm not fit to judge it, but scientists tell me that, well, yes, he's a competent man.
Mm-hmm.
That isn't the question. The question for me is whether these are the foundations on which we can build up, or whether these are necessary within the foundations of an attitude toward human relations. Whether we learn from these things what a human being ought to do toward another human being, whether science is the key to human relations, or whether science is simply a job. Let us say that one man is an incomparable engineer. Find a man who, by the application of mathematics and knowledge of stresses and of the yield of material and of the elasticity of material or the rigidity of whatever it is, thus the most extraordinary things in erecting gigantic buildings. Well, what does that make him in regard to human relations? He has gone very deeply into the atomic structure of metals and of stones and of artificial materials. What does that make of him? Suppose he has gone very deeply into the structure of the atom, and he has discovered for us the secret of the 30-odd particles which are now puzzling the scientists. What does that make him as a human being? Mm. Now, if you were to say that it is in itself beauty and poetry, I would agree with you. But whether that makes him any the more fit to judge what human beings ought to do to each other is something that I would have to consider at great length and with much reservation.
Well, I should, of course, I'm agreeing with you. I should merely like to see signs of a return to a world which kept both these things in view, which kept all human activities in view, and asked them what they meant, asked them what they promised. The great book that we are dealing with this summer, and that we deal with every summer, I think manages to keep all of life constantly in mind.
It does, yes.
And so a wise man, in the view taken by the Bible, the wise man is a man who might be trusted to consider what is best to do next. From any point of view at all, but actually from the point of view of all men, the Bible put it this way, to reverse one of Bertrand Russell's phrases, the Bible is full of cosmic piety.
Yes. You wonder at the universe. You're awestruck by the phenomenon of being of the universe as such. But I don't know whether you will find a greater depth of awe in a modern scientist than you found in poor, ignorant Job, who didn't know anything about the motions of the stars or the three laws of Kepler or Newtonian gravitation or modern time-space continuum. He was just as filled with wonder of God and of the universe as any man is today.
Well, he asked the right questions.
Well, we might, yes, and we might go on in the next talk to discuss this fundamental question of education, democracy, and the Bible.
Good.
You have just heard The Words We Live By, the ninth in the 15-week Eternal Light summer series. Be with us again next week when Maurice Samuel and Mark Van Doren will resume their discussion of democracy and the Bible. The Words We Live By is produced under the auspices of the Jewish Theological Seminary of America. This pre-recorded program has been an NBC Public Affairs presentation.
This is the NBC Radio Network.